This is an ABC podcast.
Some of the saddest stories to emerge out of sport are where once champions, titans, are left with damage to the brain from their sport that results in dementia or depression, suicide, where post-mortem they're found to have CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Hello, I'm Amanda Smith and this is Sporty. Contact and collision sports are increasingly being called to account to reduce the possibility of players getting repetitive knocks to the head. In football, of the soccer variety, those knocks come mostly from heading the ball. It's something that the former England captain, Terry Butcher, does actually want banned from the game.
Eventually, I want to see football have no heading, phase heading out. I think you have to look at safety, you have to look at, you know, families losing their loved ones too early. I think it's something that, you know, we can do without. And then it would rule out the trauma of heading a football, particularly at pace. You know, you've got to get some brain trauma in there because your brain is going to rattle against your skull. And then, of course, you're looking at collisions, aerial collisions, where, you know, you have no real control. I'd like to see it phased out, and I'd like to see a gradual process, but everybody coming together. But I don't think that people actually realise the importance of this and realise that there's something in our sport, in football, that can be catastrophic for players in the future.
That's Terry Butcher, former England captain, speaking with the BBC's Sports Desk podcast. But now, without heading, would soccer be less of a game, less of a spectacle? Well, an interesting experiment took place last month. It was a match in a town called Spennymoor in the north of England, played by ex-professional footballers. In the first half, players could only head the ball if they were within the box in front of goal. In the second half, there was no heading of the ball allowed at all. This first ever adult match to be played like this was organised by a charity called Head for Change. Dr. Judith Gates is its chair and co-founder. And Judith, why are you involved in this?
I'm involved in Head for Change for very personal reasons. My husband, Bill, is an ex-professional footballer who played for Middlesbrough in the 60s and 70s for 13 years. He was a central defender. He was known in the press as being strong in the air. And now he's paying dearly for that strength in the air. And for the last 10 years, he has been suffering from sports-related dementia, probable CTE. So my can-do husband, who has been a strong man throughout his life and has always taken the view that no problem was insurmountable, is now increasingly dependent, increasingly bewildered, and increasingly a shell of his former self. And his condition led our family to make two promises to him. The first promise was that we would help him optimize his life to the full, and that we are doing, although it's increasingly difficult. The second promise was that as his legacy and at his request, we would do all that we could to be part of the solution to sports-related dementia.
So can you tell us about this match that was played at the home ground of Spennymoor Town Football Club? How did it go? What happened?
It was a very interesting experiment. It was held at Spennymoor Town Football Club because that was Bill's very first club. Because it was a charity game, we were able to experiment, which of course you can't do in regular competitive games. And so we chose to make the experiment one of, as you have described, limiting heading. We did that not because we are promoting banning heading, but because we recognised that it was a rare opportunity to see what would happen when you did that. And it was a great opportunity to open the conversation about how the game looked when heading is either eliminated everywhere other than in the box or eliminated totally. It went in a very interesting way. In the first half, heading was allowed in the box, and comments that were made to me by both spectators and by the players said, well, there was precious little difference. We still had the excitement of corners coming into the box, but we lost the long balls that come up from the goalkeeper up the field, which are actually ones that the FA in the United Kingdom is concerned about because of the high force nature of any heading response to them. They were eliminated and that part of the game was played on the ground. In the second half, all of the game was obviously played on the ground, or the players adapted in order to chest down balls that came to them at a higher level. I was very appreciative of the fact that the players themselves, they were willing to do that because they recognise our collective responsibility for raising awareness of the dangers of heading. So a very interesting experiment.
Well, now, I'm interested that you say with Head for Change, your organisation, that you're not campaigning for a banning of heading from the game. But from within the sport, we have heard, for example, the former England captain, Terry Butcher, say that heading does need to be phased out, that people have to understand that this is something in the sport that can be catastrophic for players, as it has been for your husband, Bill. So as far as Head for Change is concerned, what's your ultimate goal?
Our ultimate goal is to begin an ongoing conversation, to encourage that conversation to be evidence-based and objective, to encourage greater understanding of the risks of heading, given that we currently know from research that there is evidence, epidemiological evidence, as well as other forms of evidence as to the dangers of heading. We do not yet know how much heading is safe. So we wish to seek primarily to protect the players, but also to be focused on protecting the game, and to be supportive of any discussion going forward that is informed and thoughtful.
So what did you learn from holding that match, Judith, and what happens next from your point of view?
What I learned from holding the match is that there is tremendous interest in this. We had television crews from Germany. We've had interest from America. I've recently had a message from India asking us what the outcome of the game was, what our thoughts were about it. So I have learned that this is sparking an international debate. One of our prime purposes is that that awareness, that knowledge, translates into knowledge for the young players coming through, learning that they are not indestructible and they may be creating in their brain from head injuries the tau that leads to tau tangles that spreads like poison ivy through their brains for the next 20 years of their lives after football, leaving them with the situation that Bill is facing and we are facing right now.
Judith, when you watch a regular game of football, soccer, now, and you see players heading the ball, say from a long kick up the field, as you must have with your husband years ago, what do you feel when you see that now?
I flinch. I flinch and I think, do they know what could potentially be happening to their brain? So I don't see anymore the skill of the response to a corner that is a header. I actually see the danger. And when I watch a game now, I flinch, because I know the potential outcomes and I know the incidence of the potential outcomes from working with other families who are suffering as we are.
And Dr. Judith Gates is the chair of the UK charity organisation Head for Change, prompted by former players like Judith's husband Bill, who has sports-related dementia and possible CTE from his days as a professional footballer. Judith, I wish you and Bill all the best, and thank you so much for speaking with me.
I appreciate that, Amanda, and thank you for the opportunity and interest.
And Judith Gates has plans to donate her husband's brain post-mortem to the Glasgow Brain Injury Research Group. This is a group led by Professor Willie Stewart, who's a neuropathologist. Willie, one of the issues with getting any changes, any reforms in sports where the head is often hit, is that whether there's a direct causal link between the sport and lasting brain injury is still contested. Where are you up to with establishing that link for soccer?
Yeah, you say that the link is contested, but to be honest, it's only contested from within sport, and in particular researchers or medics within sport who are advising them who really don't work in this field at all, possibly leading them the wrong way. Because if I put it this way, the level of evidence that's required to change the rules of the game, you know, and that's all we're talking about, is player welfare to protect the players who are playing the game, is a level which is unattainable. And so the rules of the game are being protected over the brains of the people playing the sport.
So what do you mean when you say the level of evidence is unattainable?
Well, because the people advising them are asking for longitudinal, randomized controlled studies that will look at the effects of head impacts over a player's career and into retirement. Now, there are so many flaws with that logic, one of which is that if we want to set those up now in 2021, it will be around about 2071 before we actually know whether the results are going to tell us anything or not. And I don't think we need to wait 40 to 50 years to be able to enact change to protect players' brains.
Well, there's certainly a growing number of former professional soccer players in the UK with neurodegenerative diseases, thought to be brought on by traumatic brain injury from heading the ball, like Judith Gates' husband, Bill. Is that, with the players from that generation, is that because the balls they used to play with were heavy leather ones that soaked up water on wet pitches?
No. And when you say there's a growing number of players who are developing dementia, the reality is that the number, the proportion of players developing dementia hasn't changed over the decades. We're just now recognising that the problem has always been there.
Right.
What we completed is research where we looked at the rates of dementia in former professional footballers from our Scottish population. We had about 8,000 former professional footballers, and we compared their health outcomes to around 23,000 people in the population who were as near as we could make it, those footballers, so born in the same year, living in the same areas. And what we find is that the former footballers have around about 3.5 to 4 times higher risk of developing dementia than we'd expect. And it's particularly the outfield players. So when we talk about outfield players, we're talking about defenders, where the risk is 5 times higher than it should be. Forwards, about 3 times higher than it should be. But goalkeepers' risk is not really much different to what we'd see in a population.
And is that because defenders head the ball?
Yeah, so that's data that's come from a number of different places showing that when you look at the heading frequency across footballers, defenders head more often than any of the other positions. Although it's astonishing that in, you know, almost 150 years of the association football, there's so little research has gone into heading in the game. You know, so here's a component of the game where we're throwing a ball, bouncing a ball off people's heads and rattling their brains, and yet in 150 years there's very little research that got into it. We don't know, for instance, much about what happens immediately after you head the ball, let alone what happens 20, 30 years down the line. And it's incredible that a sport should defend something where there's very little research going into the risks of it.
So just coming back to my question too about the old balls.
Well, the footballs.
Yeah, a modern lightweight football's then not any less likely to cause problems?
I'm glad you brought that up. So part of our data, we looked at the risk of dementia across last century from players born 1910 right up to 1969. So that's players playing until the late 90s. And the risk doesn't change. The risk is much the same for players across that whole period. And the so-called modern ball, the synthetic coated balls, were introduced full-time in the mid-80s. So we're seeing through that ball technology not really any great evidence of change. And I think it's a myth to believe that the old balls were heavy and the modern balls are lighter. They're exactly the same weight. The weight of an association football has been 14 to 16 ounces since the rules of football were created. The difference, as you suggested, is that the leather balls just absorb a bit of water. But in absorbing the water, their physical properties change, and so they travel at slower speeds with that increased rigidity of the ball and less compliance. And actually, when you look at the physics of impacts and footballs and impacts and footballs and heads, is the speed of the ball that's a bigger problem than the mass of the ball. So the speed, the faster travelling modern balls are arguably a greater risk than the slower travelling older balls.
Gosh. So what's the answer for you with football, soccer? Does heading the ball out and out need to go from the game?
Well, I think the sport needs to decide, is heading the ball absolutely necessary for football to continue? So in other words, you know, is a risk of dementia absolutely necessary for the game of football? Just as we say in boxing that, you know, headshots in boxing are part of the sport. Therefore, you know, we accept, boxers accept, people watching boxing accept that brain damage and dementia are a risk. I think we need to ask that same question in football. Is it necessary for players to be exposed to a risk of dementia just for our enjoyment of the game of football? Or can we look at a change in the game? Can we say that maybe there are forms of football, perhaps at amateur level, we say that the risk of dementia is not really necessary or not something we should support for amateurs, and we look at a form of the game without heading? Or we look at the professional game and say, is there a way of restricting heading to far lower levels than it is now? And that may involve, you know, rule change. But I think football, literally to bury its head in the sand and pretend there isn't a problem, is just stocking up a whole bunch of issues for the sport going forward.
And Professor Willie Stewart is a neuropathologist. He runs the Glasgow Brain Injury Research Group based at the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital in Glasgow. Willie, thank you for making time to speak with us.
It's a pleasure, thanks.
You're listening to Sporty with Amanda Smith. Now, a few weeks ago, I spoke to the bloke who owns the greenest football club in the world. That's the Forest Green Rovers in the UK. The owner of the club is Dale Vince, a green energy industrialist. And he talked about how, when he took over, he instituted a number of changes at the club in accord with his environmental and ethical principles. And that includes serving only vegan food and convincing the players to change their diet, saying that red meat is bad for athletes, it's holding them back. Well, we'll explore that idea with a sports dietitian in a few moments, but first let's go to Jason Gillespie, a former Australian cricketer, fearsome fast bowler, now a cricket coach, who chose to turn vegan. When and why, Jason?
Back in 2014, I was coaching a cricket team in the UK, Yorkshire, and my wife, Anna, and I were just one night, we were just sitting down watching a documentary. We came across Earthlings. And literally from that moment, I just made the decision that I wasn't going to consume animal products from that moment on. And I haven't done since.
Yeah. So that documentary was about the mistreatment of animals. So it was an ethical decision on your part.
Yeah. So initially, it was certainly ethical. And the more I read things and watched documentaries, the more I learnt what the industry's about, and I just made the decision that it wasn't something that I was willing to be part of. So you're right, from an ethical standpoint, it was probably my first port of call, but then certainly from a health point of view and environmental concerns, it is now obviously a combination of all three.
Now, this was after your playing career was over. By then,
yes,
You'd moved into coaching. But in your playing days, as a top-level sports person, what did you know about food and fitness? Did you pay attention to what you ate for athletic performance?
Yeah, certainly did. But I certainly didn't look at it from, I suppose, the ethical angle. I was sort of just focused on fueling my body to do my job, which was the bulk career balls.
If you had turned to a vegan diet while you were playing cricket, do you think it would have had any impact on your performance one way or other?
I certainly don't think it would have harmed me in any way. I wouldn't have had a problem if I had learnt what I learnt earlier. I wouldn't have had any qualms in observing a vegan lifestyle while I was playing international cricket. Yeah, I would have been absolutely fine.
Yeah, well, what difference has the plant-based diet made to you health and fitness-wise?
Yeah, I feel strong. One thing I have noticed is with dairy, for instance, I must have had some sort of intolerance because I always felt blocked up and sore throats and sinuses I really, really had trouble with. And, you know, literally within days of cutting out dairy, cutting out meat, I felt so much better. And, you know, my body's not ache, I had a lot of aches and pains from bowling cricket balls for a living. And by and large, I don't have any of those. I mean, these days I'm 46 years of age now, and I look to run, you know, 3 or 4 times a week, you know, distances, and feel strong and pull up well from that.
Well, what advice do you give to young cricketers, if you do at all, about yep. their diet, about eating meat or not?
Well, I'm not a dietitian. I stick to cricket coaching, and we've got people that's their job, and I respect that. If I'm asked my opinion, whether it be a player or a coach, on, you know, how I go about things, I'm happy to share that and share my story, but I'm not going to tell a player that they have to do this or have to do that. In terms of what their diet is, that's up to them. You know, do I want to see more people observe plant-based diets? Absolutely. I'd love to see more of that. My personal belief is that a vegan diet, you know, you can be a professional sportsman and thrive, but it's not my call. You know, everyone has differing thoughts and opinions on this subject, I suppose.
Yeah. And Jason Gillespie is a former Australian Test and one day international fast bowler, now head coach of the South Australian Shield team and the Redbacks Big Bash side. He's a Kamilaroi man and a committed vegan. And it's great to talk to you, Jason. Thank you.
No problem at all. It's been a pleasure.
So Jason Gillespie's motives for going vegan were first and foremost ethical. There's quite a bit around, though. For example, books by sports people, ranging from endurance runners to bodybuilders, who say that taking meat and dairy out of your diet improves athletic performance. So is a vegan diet the best one for athletes? Louise Burke was head of sports nutrition at the Australian Institute of Sport for many years and the dietitian for 5 Australian Olympic teams. She's now a professorial fellow in the Exercise and Nutrition Research Program at Australian Catholic University. And Louise, is there evidence that a plant-based diet is better for sports performance than a meat-based one?
That plays right into one of the things that most dietitians hate, and that's putting labels on diets and saying one is always better than another. So there is no evidence that a plant-based diet is better than a meat-based diet, full stop, because my interpretation could be quite different to yours. I could buy vegan chocolate biscuits and I could eat packets and packets a day and nothing else, and I would be following a vegan diet, technically. So we've got to be really careful about what we mean by a diet and how people are practicing it, and then how that compares with the athlete's goals. And they'll be different between sports, between different athletes, and between different days of the week for the same athlete. And so because the vegan diet is now very trendy, there are lots of new foods that are being introduced onto the market to make it more readily available. And so it's easier to eat well as a vegan at the moment in many ways. There are some caveats around that, of course, because one of the things that the food industry does is it makes things that we like to eat, regardless of whether they're nutritionally sound or not. And so sometimes when a diet becomes trendy, a lot of new foods appear on the market and they're not really nutritious foods, they're kind of junk foods, but they have the labels on them that say vegan or gluten-free or whatever the trend is. And sometimes people buy them and think, oh, that's great, that must be good if it's got that label on it. And they're sort of sucked into having poorer nutrient quality foods.
Okay, but then is a good vegan diet better than a good meat-based diet?
Look, that's a million-dollar question. I think in my mind, the best diet is the one that contains the most different sorts of foods, because you're able then to be able to find not just the different nutrients, but all the different combinations and food matrices, as we call them. The ways that foods are put together can have an effect on their nutritional quality, not just the individual nutrients, but something about the way the food is constructed and the way that we eat it. So I think the better variety in a diet probably adds to the chance of it being more nutritious. Another thing to think about is that diets don't have to be exclusive, because I'm fairly happy as a meat-eating person to have vegan meals, so I get the best of everything, and I don't exclusively make myself eat only one type of food than the other. And that's maybe something that we need to teach athletes, the flexibility, because they may want to be vegan for some particular reasons. And I admire people who are doing it for climate change or for animal welfare. But sometimes they may be in a situation where there's just no opportunity to have vegan foods, where they may be at some sort of an event where there's no choice. And if they have to choose between having nothing or having something that's very poor quality versus having something that includes some animal foods, then it's nice to be flexible enough to be able to meet your overall goals.
But from what you say there, there are good reasons why an athlete might choose to be vegan that doesn't necessarily have to do with their athletic performance.
That's right. Look, you know, food is much more than nutrients in the way that we eat it as humans. I mean, it fulfills so many different ways of meaning in our lives. So it's about our sense of our culture, and it's about contributing to, you know, the world and society, as well as getting nutritional meaning. So it's about choosing the things that are important to you and what opportunities you have to eat foods, and then trying to come up with the best mix. And that's why I like the idea of, you know, flexibility and range in eating rather than excluding whole food groups.
For an athlete who does want to follow a plant-based diet because of environmental reasons, animal welfare reasons, for example, what advice would you give?
I'd say to go and see a sports dietitian, because they'll be able to help the athlete then identify the range of foods that are available for them to meet their nutritional goals, and also help them with some of the practicalities of how to make it occur in their lifestyle, because it might mean they need to learn new cooking skills, or they may need to learn to read menus differently, or they may need to be able to understand food labels so that they can take what they'd like to do and actually achieve it rather than sort of making a hash of it. So the food knowledge and the practicality, as well as the specialist understanding of sports nutrition goals.
More broadly, Louise, are athletes a bit susceptible to whatever's the latest thing when it comes to diet? Again, as far as hoping to, you know, gain that performance edge?
Well, look, we're all people. And so sometimes when something new comes out, people like to be the pioneers, they like to be special, or they like to be doing whatever their friends are doing. And so it's very easy, not just if you're an athlete, but as a person to grab something that looks new and shiny and want to make use of it. What we've got to make sure is that people understand why they're making a decision about something, and if they're going to take it on, that they can do the best job. They understand the pros and the cons and the best way to adopt what they'd like to do. And so sometimes it takes a little bit more effort than most people think when they hear about this new shiny thing.
And Louise Burke is a professorial fellow in the Exercise and Nutrition Research Program at Australian Catholic University, formerly the head of sports nutrition at the Australian Institute of Sport and for Australian Olympic teams. And it's good to talk to you, Louise. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Amanda.
And next time here on Sporty, some new research on gut health. Is the microbiome of an elite athlete different to yours and mine? Could it be that gut health affects sports performance, as well as recovery from exercise and susceptibility to injury? And if that's the case, how can you and I get some of that in our guts too? Sporty is produced by Damien Rabbit. I'm Amanda Smith.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.